This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Fred Burton to the show. He's a former counterterrorism agent with the U.S. State Department, chief security officer, and vice president of intelligence and counterterrorism at Stratfor, which is a company you may be familiar with. New York Times best-selling author of several books, including Under Fire, Ghost, and Beirut Rules. We're going to talk about his days as the very first counterterrorism agent. Fred, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me on.
You're coming to us from Austin, Texas. Is that correct?
That's correct. The Stratfor corporate headquarters is here in Austin.
Good stuff. So explain to our listeners, what is Stratfor and how many people work there, for example?
We are a geopolitical intelligence company. In essence, we try to make sense of the world. We have approximately 100 employees. The bulk are headquartered here in Austin. Our founder decided that Austin would be a good place to be because it was outside of the Beltway, outside of the groupthink kind of atmosphere. So that's why we're here.
Good stuff. So are you mainly like a government contractor providing analysis and intelligence to the U.S. government mostly?
That's really one of the more interesting perceptions that people have of us. But although we do have government clients that read our analysis on a routine and daily basis, the bulk of our readership is really multinational corporations as they try to make sense of the world. And then we also have individual subscribers that subscribe to our daily website kind of content.
Right, right. I used to listen to your podcast. I don't even know if you guys are still running that, but years ago I used to listen to it. So counterterrorism, back in the days of the show 24 and CTU, the counterterrorism unit, I'm sure it's nothing like it is on TV, but that's really kind of the first time I heard that term widely used. And it's really not that old because you were right at the beginning of the counterterrorism, I guess, industry, for lack of a better word, back in the 80s, right?
I was. I was one of the first three U.S. counterterrorism agents assigned to the State Department. And I chuckled when you talked about Homeland. I was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart once, and he made that reference that I somehow was Jack Bauer, and anybody that's looked at me certainly knows that I'm not. But we had a very dysfunctional approach to terrorism in the 80s. And, of course, this is when we had all the horrific U.S. embassy bombings in Beirut two times, Kuwait. And then we had a whole smattering of hijackings from around the world, as well as aircraft bombings. So in the 80s, we were always playing catch-up, or we were always picking up the body bags, or we were very reactive, just going to the next explosion or the next threat in the world.
You say it was dysfunctional, but actually, before we get into that, how long has terrorism been around? I mean, it's kind of surprising to me, and I think maybe the listeners, that in the 80s, as far as a U.S. thing began. I mean, I guess the first instance that I would think of is the Munich Olympic Games, early 70s, I believe that was. But really, I mean, you know, you have to define terrorism, right? But it's been around for forever, maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think you're a good student of history. You're absolutely right. The 1972 Munich massacre by a group called the Black September Organization really put terrorism on the map. It was the first time that I'm old enough to remember where you had this global news broadcast underway of the Olympics And all of a sudden, you see this hooded terrorist standing on a balcony after the murder of the 11 Olympic athletes. And when you go back to the early 70s, that's when Black September, in such a short period of time, was very successful at carrying out the spectacular terrorist attacks. And that resulted in the Israeli Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, deciding that they were going to go after and hunt down and kill the terrorists involved with the Munich massacre. So that really started the counterterrorism kind of offensive kind of response capability, where they actually tried to infiltrate the organizations, hunt down the people responsible for killing their citizens, wherever they might be. So that's when it really began. And the U.S. was late to the game. Remember, the U.S. intelligence community is a product of the Cold War. And our arch enemy, the evil enemy behind everything, was Russia at the time. Quite frankly, not much has changed. But if you fast forward into the 80s, what we came to realize through our investigations and our intelligence analysis is that most of these terrorist groups from the 70s had actually been funded and trained by the Soviet Union. And they were utilizing all of these terrorist groups, like the Italian Red Brigades, the Red Army Faction, the Japanese Red Army, to destabilize the West. So it was a tool of foreign policy by the Soviet Union in many ways, early on in the game.
But the Soviets didn't create the Muslim terrorist element, did they? I mean,
they don't.
They're not tolerant of that at all in their country. Boy, you know, they don't mess around.
No, that was the new phenomena that simply caught us unaware in Beirut first in 1983, when the first embassy bombing occurred, and that's when the radical Islamic terrorism started attacking U.S. interests, predominantly due to Iranian backing. And again, you had a nation-state actor in play. So from a modeling perspective, it was very unique in that here you have the Iranians that in many ways were following the Soviet playbook of utilizing groups like Hezbollah to attack U.S. interests to try to drive us out of Lebanon, which, quite frankly, they did.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so gosh, what do I want to ask you? There are so many questions. So the Munich Games sort of put things on the map, if you will. You know, I think we should probably kind of cut to something that's breaking news. Julian Assange was just arrested as Ecuador withdrew his asylum. You probably know that. It's all over Twitter and such. What do you think? What does Stratfor think of Assange?
Well, it's an interesting question when you look at an individual like that in the day of the information space, the global information space. Certainly, when you think of it in context of foreign actors and potential involvement with other entities and so forth, I think the verdict's still out. I mean, I saw where the Eastern District of Virginia unsealed an indictment this morning regarding his association with Manning.
Chelsea Manning, Bradley Manning, right?
Correct. Okay. So I think the devil will be in the details with that. I think the Department of Justice is pretty good at connecting those dots, at least from a legality perspective.
I think, I don't know, maybe I'm just naive, but it seems to me Julian Assange is an important person to expose a lot of bad dealings. And I sort of wonder if my own country isn't just being, well, selfish. You know, I mean, I know he did some things, obviously, that the U.S. is very bothered about, but is there any good to Julian Assange?
I probably am the wrong person to ask that question because I don't know him personally.
Right.
I think when you look back and you look at the allegations that perhaps he and his organization are associated with other kinds of nation-state actors, that's the kind of thing that the intelligence community looks at very closely. And I know from working behind the firewall, so to speak, in those kinds of scenes that they're pretty good at connecting those dots, you know, utilizing all the tools that the intelligence community have at their disposal. So I know indictments and so forth, the threshold is pretty darn high in any U.S. judicial kind of process before any U.S. attorney will even accept a case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I think it was maybe your first book about that's the Confessions book, talking about your life in counterterrorism. What are some of those confessions, if you will? Such a interesting behind the scenes world. You know, we all love watching spy movies and so forth. So teach us something.
One of the things that Random House wanted to do with the story is we kind of made the plane crash which killed President Zia of Pakistan in 1988 is the center of the book. It has more chapters than any other story in the book. It was a case that I personally investigated, and it also killed our United States ambassador, Arnie Rafel, as well as the entire Pakistani equivalent of our cabinet when PAC-1 crashed in the desert in 1988. So that's the kind of story that's behind the scenes that I tried to write about my involvement, trying to figure out how the plane crashed, try to figure out the actors that might have been involved. And that's one of the reasons why when the terrorist attack took place in Benghazi, I wanted to tell that story, because when Ambassador Stevens was killed in Benghazi, he actually was the last U.S. ambassador killed in the line of duty before Ambassador Rafel was killed in Pakistan in 1988. So there was kind of a personal arc for me there. Since I had investigated the previous one, I wanted to also look into what happened in Benghazi and tell that story from the eyes of the young special agents that were there saddled to try to protect Ambassador Stevens when the terrorists came over the walls there.
Hillary Clinton, I mean, she's been implicated widely in the Benghazi fiasco, or tragedy, I guess I should call it. That's really what it is. It's a terrible tragedy. Where do you stand on Hillary Clinton? It seems like she just ignored. It's just mind-boggling to me what happened there. I've done some interviews on this incident, but it's been a few years. So to give us your perspective.
Well, I think governments are reactive. They're not proactive. That's the first thing I learned when I was an agent. And that in many ways, you're on your own at times, and that everything's fine until things go south, per se. And then there's always, your accountability review boards. There's always the witch hunts that follow. Now, I can say this in any government agency that I've ever worked in, that it's rare for a cabinet-level official to make any real tactical decisions on any given day. And I think in Benghazi, the mistake was made with the U.S. ambassador being in Benghazi on the anniversary of 9/11 to begin with. And then from a practical level, the agents did not have in the safe room smoke hoods, which is a device that you put over your head from a survival perspective. And that was a human error failure, that if they had had smoke hoods there, they might have been able to wait out the fire, and they might have been able to try to keep Ambassador Stevens alive. So, but it really backs up with Stevens' decision to go to Benghazi that day. As the chief of mission and the president's rep to any nation, it's very difficult to override him. And there wasn't a lot of oversight in Washington, nor is there ever on the activities or travels of any specific U.S. ambassador.
Mm-hmm. That's just such a tragic, terrible story. But it just seems like our government just abandoned those people.
Well, I think that, there certainly were some poor choices made, beginning with the U.S. ambassador deciding to go there that day. Mm-hmm. And it's like anything else in this business. Things are fine until things go south, and then everybody wants to know how the heck did this happen. Yeah. But when you also look at the organization that I came from, and I'm very sympathetic to the plight of the poor agents that were there, because I was one of those poor agents many years ago sent to investigate these kinds of horrific events. And I can tell you that for the most part, you don't have enough resources. You're doing the best you can, and you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What else would you like people to know about counterterrorism or anything that Stratfor is up to?
Well, I've got a new book out called Beirut Rules, which is the story of the only CIA station chief ever to be kidnapped and murdered. Mm-hmm. And I've been working a lot with doing book talks and so forth and media surrounding it. I spent a great deal of time piecing together the event involving the kidnapping and in essence, Iran's support for the organization that kidnapped the station chief in the 1980s. And, the one thing about this business is you have so well laid out is the arc here that, in many ways, everything that we were dealing with in the 1980s, we're still dealing with today,
mm-hmm.
whether that be nation-state-sponsored espionage, nation-state-sponsored terrorism, and it certainly resonates today.
Yeah, it sure does. Where do we go from here? Like, what does the future hold? And by the way, and I know that's a loaded question, of course, but I also just want to raise one other issue, and it seems to have been forgotten. And I used to talk about it with guests all the time. Everybody was so outraged. Whatever happened to, have we just accepted that the NSA is going to do what they do and listen in and eavesdrop on all of us all the time? Is that just okay now? That's the new normal. That just sort of evaporated. It's mind-boggling how comfortable we get with stuff.
I think you raise a very good point. I mean, I can remember a day as an agent actually trying to get some NSA help on an American citizen
mm-hmm.
that I was convinced that was involved in terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, I was kicked out of the building. They said, we can't help you. We can't collect on American citizens. There's nothing we can do.
We can't collect data, you mean, right?
Yeah, we can't collect data. We can't help you with this problem, Fred. You're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen this pendulum swing so far in the other direction
mm-hmm.
to the point that I think you're right. People just kind of expect this today. But I can remember a day, and it wasn't that long ago, but I guess it was in hindsight,
mm-hmm.
when this was something that the NSA stayed away from. And they never collected information on Americans in any capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the strategic strike by Al-Qaeda on 9/11 changed things drastically. And so the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really has. Where do we go? What's the future of terrorism and counterterrorism? I mean, how concerned should we be? You know, are there any new terrorism fighting techniques that, you know, maybe the general public doesn't know about yet? I mean, I'm sure there's lots of them that you can't talk about, but whatever you can share.
Well, I think these incidents of mass violence like we saw in Las Vegas are certainly going to continue. I think it's impossible to stop some of these events. It's so easy today when you don't need to know how to make a bomb, you don't need to even acquire a firearm. You can just use a car, you could use a truck or a van just to drive into a crowd. I think the public and the media have unrealistic expectations on the part of the ability of law enforcement or the intelligence community to stop those. I'm here to tell you they're practically impossible to stop without a human source to report what that person is doing. Those are the kinds of things that I think are going to continue. Your active shooter events, I think, are going to continue inside your usual soft targets, whether that be churches or schools, I'm sad to say.
Well, sadly, you know, they've basically, the government has said, you know, these places can't protect themselves. You know, schools, you know, they know they're just open game. There's no security.
Yes, without a doubt. And I think that there's a copycat factor there where they just feed on each other,
yep.
like we've seen happen, whether it be the horrific attack on the mosque in New Zealand to some of the church shootings that we've had here in the United States. By just good police work on occasion, the FBI is able to circumvent some of these attacks, but we're not going to be able to stop these. And therefore, it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure you have a plan, you have a personal plan, you maintain a degree of situational awareness to know where you're at, how to get out of a movie theater, how to get out of a school. Do you know how to stop the bleed? Do you have a tourniquet? Those are the kinds of things that I think people have to realize, that they're not going to be able to rely upon the government to be able to stop these. And it takes forever at times to get help to you, God forbid, if one of these events breaks out while you're in the midst of it.
Yeah, you know, good point. I mean, you know, maybe we just have to learn to live more like the Israelis have been living for many years. When I was in Israel, I remember, you'd be in a restaurant and my backpack would be under the table and someone would come by every few minutes and say, is that your backpack? Very concerned. All the trash cans were clear, you know, so you could see what's inside them. There are just a multitude of preventions and extra efforts that have to be taken to combat this terrible thing that we have to live with nowadays. It's a lot of effort. You know, you look at every government building, probably people don't even notice. I was just saying this to my girlfriend the other day, you know, as we were walking by a government building, I think we were, where were we? Phoenix, I think. And I said, look at that building. See all the barricades? You don't even know those bus benches are barricades, do you? And they're just concrete, you know, heavy, really heavy things. So you can't drive a truck into it. There's no parking around the building like there used to be. You know, it's all just a different world, isn't it?
It most certainly is. And I've seen this evolution. And the interesting part here, and you touched on something that I do want to mention, because U.S. government entities and military bases and embassies have heavied up to the point from a physical security perspective that it's very difficult to attack them. The threat has been pushed on to the public sector. Mm-hmm. The threat has been pushed into the public arena and into the multinational corporation kind of workspace, because the governments have monies to be able to put these physical security barriers around. A lot of companies don't, mm-hmm. and a lot of retail establishments can't. So there is that kind of blowback when you start looking at that, too, from what's happened with our homeland security efforts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, you know, and that's, I talk a lot about identity theft. It's really the kind of the crime of our time, you know, because everyone is much more secure now. Every house has an alarm system nowadays, not everyone, but obviously a lot of them do. You know, everything has been beefed up. You know, we're all much more aware and careful. We're walking down the street. We're not as dumb as we used to be because society is not as peaceful as it used to be. And, you know, everybody wised up. So now the criminals got into identity theft. You know, that's a whole different kind of thing. And we're all learning about that now. And then they'll go to something else. You know, it's wherever the easiest opportunity is. If your house is protected and lighted and alarmed, you know, they're going to go to your neighbor's house. It's the same idea, right?
Absolutely. A long time ago, before I was a special agent, I was a cop. And I never remember taking a police report of a burglary of a house where someone had a dog. Mm-hmm. Because the dog barked, therefore the burglar would go to a house that doesn't have a dog.
Right.
So your example with the cyberspace is absolutely correct and a very good analogy.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot more people have a dog now, in other words, right? So they've got more security.
Or should have one.
Yeah, right. Good point. All right. Give out your website and tell people where they can find out more.
Absolutely. Anybody interested in Stratfor can go to www.stratfor.com or visit my website, which is officialfredburton.com.
Fred, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.